Good morning. It's good to see everyone this morning. We have enjoyed our time here at the Cary Church of Christ and have looked forward to this for several months and got to spend some time with some pretty awesome young people yesterday and teach God's Word. It doesn't get much better than that, so thank you for having us. My wife, Brooke, is sitting right here. Wave, honey. There you go. There she is. Our kids, Ava, Greta, and Willa, they're 5, 4, and 9 months, all girls. So pray for me. But we've enjoyed it. We stayed at the La Quinta, a real nice hotel that is Spanish for no sleep, is what La Quinta seems to mean. But that's not the hotel's fault. That's the baby's fault. But we're incredibly excited to be with you. And if you have your Bibles with you this morning, go ahead and turn to Acts chapter 27. And this morning's lesson is going to seem a little bit random, but if you'll stick with me, I think it'd be very interesting to you. And also, I think it'd be very helpful in your faith. It's not a chapter that I would have immediately gone to for most of my life as anything that I would like to know more about, to be honest with you. I don't like boats, and I get lost really easily. So when I'm reading this chapter, I'm lost in my own mind, and I feel disoriented, and I feel like, well, I just don't want to go on this trip with Paul, if that's all right with you. And so generally when I'm reading through my Bible and I get to Acts 27, at least before I studied it, I would kind of skim through it at best, but I would never really study it very deeply. I don't know how many of you have studied this chapter in depth. It's incredibly interesting. And so that's what we're going to do this morning. And as a little bit of a backdrop preview, Paul is a prisoner of the Roman government at this point. And he's been held captive for stuff that he never did. He's been falsely accused. And he's gotten to the point where he's just appealed to Caesar. If you guys are not going to do me right, if you guys are going to continue to allow these false witnesses to come in, I appeal to Caesar. And once you do that, then they just send you to Rome. And so this chapter is Paul getting on a ship with a few other people and headed towards Rome. Now, I put this map up here because this is going to be very helpful for us as we go through this chapter. This is the journey. Do you see the black line starting over here on the right of the screen at Caesarea and ending up on the left at Rome? This is the journey. This is about a 2,000-mile journey, not in a SUV, and not on a train, and not on a subway, and not on an airplane for sure. This is a 2,000-mile journey in a boat or a ship. So as we look at this story, I want you to think about that. I want you to put yourself in the shoes of the people, especially Paul, who would have been on this ship. And we're going to break this up into some sections and talk about it and make some application at the end that I think is incredibly interesting and helpful. So scholars say about this chapter, and this is one of the most interesting beginnings to this study, they say that this chapter contains more information about ancient seafaring than any other first century source. Don't you think that's interesting? That the Bible nowhere claims to be a book on seafaring. No, the Bible nowhere claims to be a nautically, you know, inspired book. You know, this is all about how to get your ship from Caesarea to Rome, and we'll tell you how to do it. The Bible doesn't make that claim, but it's interesting that when the Bible records information about something, it's always accurate. It's the same thing about science. The Bible's not a science book, but when the Bible talks about science, it's telling the truth and it's accurate. Same thing with geography and archaeology. The Bible is always true. So as we look through this, I think you'll find it interesting. Let's look at verses 1 through 3 together, and then let's talk about it for just a moment. I'm going to call this section Smooth Sailing. Smooth sailing is what we're going to title this. And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramidium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day, we put in at Sidon. And Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. Does that sound like smooth sailing so far? Everything seems to be going fine. You can see where they've gone from Caesarea to Sidon. Not very far, but they've gotten started in a good way on this journey. Now, there were several kinds of ships that could be sailed in these days. Some were very large, that would be equipped to go into open sea to transport cargo through shipping lanes. Others were not large at all. They were more port-hopping ships. What that means is they would move very closely along the coastlines from port to port. So what kind of ship are we probably on here? Probably on that second kind of smaller ship. We don't have a lot of passengers mentioned here, and we're going from one little port to the next little port, not necessarily going into the open sea. Julius, one of the men that's mentioned on this in this first three verses, the Roman centurion, he began this journey as the man with the most authority on the ship. And actually, if you think about it, he even had more authority on this little ship than the owner and the captain, if you look at verse 11, because they look to him as the person who will be making the decision. So this man, Julius, is really, in some ways, in a lot of ways, in charge of this trip. He's a very noble man, as you see, even in the first three verses. He's kind to Paul. In fact, it's interesting to me, every single time you look in the New Testament and you see an account of a Roman centurion, they're good men. I think that's interesting, and I think that's kind of important. And this is certainly the case here. He had some soldiers with him, according to verses 31 and 32, and you can be sure that these soldiers were the very best. These were cream of the crop Roman soldiers, and Julius was a good man and kind to Paul. The captain and the crew, and likely the first mate, would have begun this journey with their fair share of authority as well. They would have been responsible, as you can imagine, for the technical know-how of operating and navigating this ship. Julius may have been the one that made the decisions, but the captain and the crew would have been the ones that carried out these decisions. Paul, however, begins this journey as a what? He's a prisoner. And literally, how much authority does he have? Zero. I mean, how much do you think they're going to consider what Paul has to say about this trip? They might not even really consider Paul to be part of this trip, if you really want to get down to it. He's almost cargo. He's a person they have to get from one place to the other, and they're kind to him, but make no mistake, he's really not got a lot of power, if any, on this ship. He's probably kept in the hold of this small ship, and as far as everybody else is concerned, he's just a total nobody. Now, do we know better? Is Paul a nobody? Well, this is a neat setup, isn't it? If you're watching this as a movie and you're watching all these important people loaded into this boat and Paul goes in chains and he's at the back of the line and everybody else thinks, well, get this no good, nobody prisoner, and we're watching thinking, oh, I know who that is. You know, this is a neat setup. This is Paul going into something in one kind of with one kind of perception and going to come out with a very different perception, isn't he? So this is a pretty neat setup. Something had happened beforehand in Caesarea, or maybe during that one-day journey, or maybe both, that gave Julius some reason to think that he could allow Paul to go ashore and receive care from his friends. Don't you think that's interesting? He didn't have to do that, and typically that probably wasn't what the Roman centurion would do with a prisoner, but Paul has been a prisoner for more than 2 years. He's been accused of things that would give Rome some reason to be cautious about him. Acts 24, verse 5, if a Roman soldier lost a prisoner due to negligence or a bad decision-making on their part, what was the price? Their life was the price. So we're taking a bit of a risk if we're Julius. And Paul got some special treatment here for one conceivable reason, and that is that Julius seemed to trust him. Julius has made some kind of connection with Paul, and he's given him some rope, as it were. Now, as we move to verse 4 through 8, we're going to entitle this section, Rougher Waters. Rougher Waters. Now let's read. And putting out to sea from there, and watch this on the map, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. So if you're following along on the map, by the end of this particular passage, we have gone from Sidon all the way to this little island in the middle of the map there, Fair Havens. And it wasn't smooth sailing. Did you notice that? Now, again, how many miles did we just cover in four verses? I don't think any of us got really an indicator of exactly what happened in those four or five verses. We just read it, and we're going to move on. But let's pause and make sure we have some appreciation for what is being talked about here. We find several phrases in this passage that make it clear that we're not going smoothly anymore. Cyprus is an island just south of Asia Minor, and Myra is a harbor town a little further west and just on the southern tip of Asia Minor. So after leaving Sidon, they headed west toward Rome. Cyprus was the closest island. It says they sailed closely to the eastern shore of Cyprus, that's leeward, to avoid the strong west wind that was against them. Now watch the map and look at this. The quickest route as the crow flies would have been a straight shot west from Sidon to Rhodes on the open sea. But because of the wind and the type of ship that they were in, their route took the longer but safer course along the coast. Okay? After they get to Myra, what do they do? Because they don't like this boat anymore. Let's get a better vehicle. Okay? It's kind of like if you go to rent a car and they give you these little bitty, what are they called? The smart cars? What a horrible name. How smart in the world is it to be smaller than everything on the road, including the roadkill? If you get 10 miles down the road, you're going to trade that in. Give me a Buick, you know. Give me something big that I can feel safe in. So they get this big ship, this ship of Alexandria, sailing for Italy, which is where they're going. So they basically, Julius begins, he gets all of his people and they board that ship. It's obviously a much larger ship. Verse 37 tells us how many people were on it. How many people were on it? Y'all with me? 276 people on this one. So this is a significantly bigger ship. This is also a ship with an agenda. Believe me, they're not going to Rome on the kind of cruise that you and I might go on. You know, where's the seafood buffet? Probably nowhere to be found. Probably under the water. Okay, so this is a ship with an agenda. This is a ship with cargo. This is a ship where you're talking about people who are interested in making their money. You with me? That's what's going on here. It also adds to the authority that's on board now, the opinions, the purposes. It confuses things. It complicates things a little bit. It's registered in Alexandria, which is in Egypt. So it was probably one of the grain transport vessels and therefore a big payday for the crew when they arrived with their cargo. Now keep that in mind. You got 276 people on this ship, most of whom are expecting when they get where they're going, give me my money. And this may be a large sum of money for the length of the trip that they're making. Now, the sailing was slow, it says here in this passage, for a number of days. By the way, the sailing season was very quickly coming to an end in this part of the world. Scholars think that it was around mid-August based on some of the clues about the wind patterns, which means that traveling in the Mediterranean Sea here was about to become very risky. This was becoming very dangerous for anybody to get out on the open sea for any reason. And so these guys are pressing their luck at this point in the year. And so what made the sailing slow, and the Bible talks about this, it was a sailing maneuver that they had to do called tacking. It's the only real way to go forward if you're in a headwind. And tacking, you steer a zigzag course, and you go with the wind with your sails up, and then you turn against it and put them down and get as much ground as you possibly can doing it that way. How fast do you think that works? How easy do you think that is for the crew of this ship who's just constantly working and putting sails up and pulling sails down and turning these wheels and really trying against all of nature's influence to go the other direction? It's very difficult, labor intensive. It makes for a very frustrating number of days. Okay, it's not hard for us to read the phrase number of days and think, well, you know, I've had a number of days. Probably not like these numbers of days. This is very difficult. The wind is getting stronger. The sailing is getting more difficult. And even tacking, that plan we talked about, it's not getting very good results apparently. And they're unable to port at Cnidus because of the weather. So their ship is driven into the open sea and they're forced to sail south toward the island of Crete. They would have some protection from the winds around that island and hopefully find a safe harbor. And you see where we're talking about. That island down in the middle of the map is where they are forced to kind of head toward. And hopefully we get to this place and we get a little bit of a break from the wind by being around this land. And so that's what they do. The information contained in verses 7 and 8 is so brief. It's so brief we can't possibly get a sense of the difficulty that they would have experienced along the coast of Crete. Take a look at that little bitty island on this big picture. It's about 170 miles long and only 35 miles wide at its widest point. From Salmone to Fair Havens would have been about 140 miles. So when you say we coasted along with difficulty, that's not like getting in your car, setting the cruise control, and having a headache. Coasting along with difficulty, it doesn't mean that. In this particular situation, this is something that we're really going to have trouble really understanding how hard this was. And when you get to this place called Fair Havens, that's probably an overstatement, and that's probably not at all a description of what this place felt like to them. It was a small port with an open bay. It was sheltered only by two small islands. Luke said that it was not suitable, verse 12, to spend the winter in, but they're stuck there for now. Okay, they're stuck. Keep in mind also, the conflicting goals of the 276 people on this ship are probably making things a little tense. Would you imagine? We want to do this because of this. Oh, no, we need to do this because of this. No, if you'll consider all these issues, this is what we need to do. I guarantee you they're having some tense moments. The captain and the crew of this ship are not going to be excited about a four-month delay for winter, which would mean paying the crew's wages and buying their supplies during that time, and it would have been an economic disaster to have to stay here. But that's what it's looking like, okay? So try to be on this boat. Picture this as a movie, and all these nearly 300 people, this is getting kind of tense. And Paul is, again, probably nowhere to be found, probably has no say and no voice in this issue. So when we come to verse 9 through 12, we're going to call this decision time. It's time to make a decision. Let's read. Since much time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous, because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Does this sound like a sure thing? Somehow, maybe there's a chance. Whew, I don't want to be on that ship, do you? That does not sound good. This is getting dangerous. The fast, which is mentioned here, is the Day of Atonement, which is observed on the 10th day of the 7th month on the Jewish calendar, which makes it close to the beginning of October. And as you'll know if you study this kind of issue, crossing the open sea during that time of year was literally gambling with your own life. They knew it. But the stakes for them were so high that they couldn't stay, in their mind, they couldn't stay at Fair Havens. It's too economically horrible for us to stay in this port. So they head for Phoenix because it's more protected from winds and better suited to winter in. If they were going to have to stay somewhere for the winter, they were going to have to move anyway. So Phoenix is only about 40 miles from Fair Havens, which would have been a relatively short trip, but they didn't make it. And again, picture this. This is not really a map that we're talking about. This is a group of people in the water. Picture being in the ship in the water with these people at this time when you didn't even know how much of a chance you had to begin with, and now you missed the chance that you had. Paul tried to warn them, didn't he? He finally spoke up. Hey, guys, excuse me. I just have to say something. Okay? He tried to warn them, but who is he to them? He's a nobody. He is literally a nobody. They didn't listen to his advice. They had, in their minds, no reason to listen to Paul. Even though Paul has been in at least three shipwrecks and has some experience in traveling this part of the world at this point, nobody listens to him. In their mind, they all had a good reason to keep moving, even though it could cost them their lives. Money and duty are powerful motivators, aren't they? Wanting to get paid and wanting to do your job are powerful motivators. And so the majority ruled over common sense, over well-known weather patterns, and over safety. And Paul's warning was most likely acknowledged by Julius, but ultimately blown off. Now we come to a section in verses 13 through 17 that we'll call the storm. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind called the Northeaster struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear and thus they were driven along. Did you see what just happened here? I want you to look at that big old section of water on the left of this map, because that's where we're about to get pushed into. The Northeaster. Think about this. A storm so bad that we name it. We still do that. When you name a storm, it's not nice. Okay? When you name something like this, it means, oh, let's show some respect. Let's give it a name. The Northeaster is a fierce hurricane force wind from the northeast, obviously. Comes off the mountains above Lebanon and blows the cold winter air in hard blasts across the Mediterranean Sea. So powerful that they just gave way to it. We're not going to make it to Phoenix. And they end up about 25 miles southeast of Crete, taking some shelter from the small island of Cauda. How small is it? So small that it doesn't even appear on this map. It's tiny, down below that island of Crete, right in the middle of the map, but it's so small that you can't see it. And it got so dangerous, they were barely able to secure the ship's lifeboat. It's in danger of breaking into pieces. It says in this passage, they use supports to undergird the ship. This is sailing terminology. This is a procedure known as frapping. They're not making you a drink at McDonald's, trust me. It's not that kind of frap. The hulls of those ships used tongue and groove construction sealed with pitch. During storms like this one, the slats would be under tremendous stress. They'd be in danger of coming apart at crucial points. So the crew would pass large cables or ropes under the ship and winch them together on the deck just to hold it together like a science project for a third grader. Just keep this thing from falling apart. They didn't want the violent winds to run them aground on the nearby Syrtis sands, is what that is. There are two celebrated Syrtis or quicksands on the coast of Africa called the Greater and the Lesser. These were these vast beds of sand driven up by the sea, and they were constantly shifting in their position. They didn't really know where they might run into them. So they were constantly changing their position. They couldn't be accurately found on a chart. And the sailors were scared that they were going to get run onto one of these sand beds and the ship was going to be destroyed. So they just decided we'll be better off to just let this storm take us out to sea. Now, who's in charge now? Nobody on this boat, are they? Now, you could say, you know, if we were talking about characters in the story, that the storm is in charge. But who's in charge of the storm? Now, this is where everything really begins to get hairy here. This is where you just don't really want to be on this ship, if you ever did. We're going to call verses 18 through 29 dire straits. Listen to what happens next. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship, and he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul.